Thanks very much. This is the 27th meeting of the new right, and we've waited quite a long time to discuss one of the most important thinkers of the radical right and of a traditional perspective upon mankind and reality, and that is Baron Julius Evola. Now, Evola is, in some respects, to the right of everybody that we've ever considered in nearly any of these talks, and not in a sort of unprofound or sententious manner. Julius Evola was somebody who rejected purposefully and metaphysically the modern world. Now, what does that mean? It basically means that at the beginning of the last century, Baron Evola, who's a Sicilian baron, decided that there were about four alternatives in relation to modern life for those of a heroic spirit. One was suicide, and to make off with oneself by opening one's veins in the warm bath like Sicilian mafiosi and Italian cardinals and Sicilian sort of brigands and ancient Romans. Another was to become a Nietzschean, which for many people in tradition is a modern version of some, but by no means all, of their ideas, and is a way of riding the tiger of modernity and dealing with that which exists around us now. Later, people like Evola and other perennial traditionalists, as we may well call them, became increasingly critical of Nietzsche and regard him as a sort of decadent modern and an active nihilist who has a bit of spirit and vigour but doesn't really have the real position. I made things quite clear. I would be regarded by most people as a Nietzschean, and philosophically that's the motivation I've always had since my beginning. That's why parties don't really mean that much to me, because ideas are eternal, and ideas and values come back, but movements and the ways and forms that they take and the expressions that they have come and go. Now, moving from the Nietzschean perspective, which of course relates to the great German thinker at the end of the 19th century and his active and quasi-existential and volitional view of man, is the idea of foundational religiosity or primary religious and spiritual purpose. In high philosophy, there are views which dominate everyone around us, and modern media and everyone who goes to a tertiary educational college such as a university in a Western world. These are modern ideas which are materialistic and anti-spiritual and a-spiritual and anti-religious or antagonistic to prior religious belief, so much so that it's taken as a given that those are the views that one holds. All of the views that have convulsed the Western intelligentsia since the Second European Civil War, which ended in 1945, ideas like existentialism and behaviorism and structuralism and so on, are all atheistic and material views. They've been discussed in other meetings. If one goes back slightly, one has various currents of opinion, such as Marxism and Freudianism and behaviorism, beginning in the late 19th century and convulsing much of the 20th century. But these are views that an advanced, Evolian-type perspective rejects. These views are anti-metaphysical and often counter the idea that metaphysics doesn't exist, that it's the school returning of the late medieval period, what was called the medieval schoolmen. Seeing some of his books, Evola talks about Heidegger, Martin Heidegger, of course, who got into trouble in the early 1930s for his alleged academic sort of positioning in relation to the most controversial regime of modernity. Heidegger, in my opinion, and I've talked about Heidegger before, is a quasi-essentialist to essentialist thinker. Evola believes he's an existentialist, but that's largely by the by. These anti-metaphysical views are that which surrounds us. All liberalism, all feminism, all quasi-Marxism, all bourgeois Marxism, all cultural Marxism, the extreme left moderated a bit into the centre, high capitalist economics and the return of old liberalism against the Keynesianism, which was the soft Marxism that replaced it earlier in the 20th century. All of these ideas are materialistic and atheistic and a-spiritual and anti-metaphysical. You could argue that the heroic Nietzschean dilemma in relation to what's called modernity is a quasi-metaphysical and metaphysically subjectivist view, that there are values outside man and outside history that human beings commune with by virtue of the intensity with which they live their own lives. But there is a question mark over, one, the supernatural, and two, whether there is anything beyond and outside man within which those values could be anchored. So the idea of an impermanence, the idea of a metaphysical realm, which most prior civilizations, indeed Evelyn the traditionalist would say all prior civilizations are based on, is questioned by the Nietzschean compact. It is ultimately, maybe, the beginnings of a very right-wing modern view, but it is a modernist view. Take it or leave it. The sort of viewpoint that Evelyn moved towards, and there was a progression in his early life and spiritual career and intellectual and writing career, is towards what we might call metaphysical objectivism. This is called, in present-day language, foundationalism or fundamentalism in relation to religiosity. Fundamentalism, like the far right, are the two areas of culture that can't be assimilated in what exists out there in Praed Street. They're the two things that are outside, and that's why they can never entirely be drawn in. Now, metaphysical objectivism is the absolute belief in the supernatural, the absolute belief in other states of reality, the absolute belief in gods and goddesses, the absolute belief in one supreme power, monotheism as against polytheism, for example, the absolute belief that certain iterations, certain forms of language and spiritual culture exist outside man, truth, justice, the meaning of law, purposive or teleological information about how a life should be lived. Most people in Western societies now are so dumbed down and so degraded by almost every aspect of life that nearly any philosophical speculation about life is indeterminate and almost completely meaningless. It's a channel which they never turn on. Now, the type of metaphysical objectivism that Evelyn postulates as being an anchor for meaning in modern life can take many different forms. One of the great problems many right-wing or refoundational or primal movements or tribal movements or nationalistic movements of whatever character have is if there's a religion somewhere behind it, as there often is for many but not all of the key people involved in such movements and struggles, what form should that be? Everyone knows that culturally, and this is true of a formulation like Grèce or the New Right in France, as soon as you begin to get people of like mind together, they will split. They will split on whether they're atheists or not, secularists or not, but they were also at a deeper cultural level split on whether they're pagan influenced or Christian. Such divisions always bedevil right-wing cultural and metapolitical groups. The way that the Evelyn tradition and looks at this is to engage in what's called perennialism. This is the inherent intellectual and ideological and theological idea that there are certain key truths in all of the major faiths. All of those faiths that have survived, that are recorded, that have come down to us, even their pale antecedents, even those dissident, deviant, and would-be heretical elements of them that have been removed, in all of them can be seen a shard of the perspectival truth that these particular traditions could be said to manifest. Beneath this, of course, is the ethnic and racial idea that people in different groups within mankind as a body perceive reality differently, experience it differently, have different intellectual and linguistic responses to it, and form different cults, different myths, different religions, because they are physically constituted in a manner that leads to such differentiation. This can lead among certain perennialists to a sort of universalism at times, almost a neoliberalism occasionally, where all cultures are of value, where all are interesting, quote unquote, where all are quite slightly interchangeable. But given that danger, the advantage for a deeply religious mind of the perennial tradition is to avoid the sectarianism and negative puritanism, which is inevitably part and parcel of building up large religious structures. As always, a thinker like Evelyn proceeds from the individual and goes to. This can give thinking of this sort a slightly unreal aspect for many people. Where are the masses? Where is the democratic majority? Where is the BBC vote that decides? The truth is, Evelyn's not concerned with the BBC vote. He's not concerned with the masses. He regards the masses, and the sort of theorists who go along with him, regard the masses as sacks of potatoes to be moved about. His thinking is completely anti-democratic. Machiavellian to a degree, and even manipulative of the masses, as long as it's done within an order of tradition within which all have a part. Ever the dates the decline of modernity from, in a sense, the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Renaissance, but many thinkers of a similar sort date the slide at other times. Evola's a Catholic, and once asked about his religious peculiarity, he said, or particularism, he said, "I'm a Catholic pagan," which is a deeply truthful remark, dialectically. "I'm not a Christian, but if you look at it from the outside, the core or part of Christianity is obviously Roman Catholicism, even though I was technically brought up in the Protestant sort of forcing house of Anglicanism, a wet sheet religion if ever there was one." But Anglicanism, of course, is a syncretic religion, it's a politically created religion, a bit Catholic, a bit Protestant, but not too much, and with a liberal clerisy at the top that's partly Protestant-oriented within it and exists to manage the thing. One of the truthful, although this is en passant, one of the truthful asides that can be made about Anglicanism and the reason why it's been supported even today through state establishmentarianism, when virtually no one attends these churches at all, except the odd old lady and immigrants from the third world, is that it's a way of damming up some of the extremism that does lurk in religion. Religion is a very dangerous formulation, as the modern world is beginning to understand. I remember Robin Cook, who was a minister opposed to the Iraq War and so on, and died on a Welsh or on a Scottish mountain. All that obsessive walking when one's thin and red-headed can lead to undue coronaries. But Cook once said, when we were young, and he's a son of the manse, like most of these Scotch politicians are. In other words, he comes from a Calvinistic background to a degree. He said that in his early life, he thought, with the general Marxist and Freudian conundrums, that religion was over. And now, towards the end of his life, this is just before he died, he said the dark, clammy, icy hand of religiosity in all sorts of systems is rising again. And secular leftists like us, he's speaking of himself and those who believe in his viewpoint, are feeling the winds of this force coming from the side and from behind them. And it's a force that they don't like. I personally believe that, as with Evola, that people are hardwired for faith. Maybe 1 in 10 have no need of it at all. But for most people, it's a requirement. The depth of the belief, the knowledge that goes into the belief, the system they come out of, is slightly incidental. But man needs emotional truths. George Bernard Shaw once said, "The one man with belief is worth 50 men who don't have any." And it's quite true that all of the leaders of great movements and those that impose their will upon destiny inside and outside of particular countries have considerable and transcendent beliefs, philosophical, quasi-philosophical, religious, semi-religious, philosophical, melded into religious, and vice versa. Without the belief that there's something above you, and before you, and beyond you, and behind you that leads to that which is above you, we seem as a species content to slough down into the lowest common denominator, the lowest possible level. Evola and those who think like him believe that this is the lowest age that mankind has ever experienced. Despite its technological abundance, despite its extraordinary array of technological devices that even in an upper pub room in central West London you can see around you. It is also true, and this is one of the complications of his sorts of beliefs, that some of the methodologies that have led to this plasma screen behind me would actually be denied by elements of some of the religiosity that people like him would put forward. But that's one of the conundrums about epistemology, about what you mean by meaning, which lurks in these types of theories. The interesting thing about these beliefs is that they're primal. Turn on the television, turn on the radio, the World Cup is just about to begin. Everywhere there is trivia, everywhere there is celebration of the majority, everywhere there is celebration of the desire for us all to embrace and become one world together. I met somebody recently who said, "I don't want to be English." He said, "I don't want to be British." He said, "England's a puddle," he said. "I want to step out." He said, "I want to be a citizen of the world. I don't want to have a race. I don't want to have a kind. I don't want to have a group, even a class. I don't want to come from anywhere. I want to be on this planet. This planet is my home. Well, my view is that sort of fake universality, maybe should get in one of these little dinky rockets and fire himself off into some other firmament. Because this is the home that we have and know. And the only reason that we can define it as such is by virtue of the diversity of what exists upon it. But the number of people who wish to retain that diversity and the pregnant meanings within it seem to get smaller and smaller with each generation. The politicians that we have now are managers of a social system. It's quite clear that we do not have three ruling parties, but one party with three wings, the nature of which are interchangeable in relation to gender, where you come from in the country, class, background, how you were educated, and whether you arrived in the country as a newcomer in the last 40 to 50 years or not. Now, ever those step back from what has made the modern world leads to certain radical conclusions about it which are spiritually and politically aristocratic. Most people are only aware of the left-right split as it relates to a pre-immigration, slightly organic society where social class was the basis for political alignment. Bourgeois, centre-right, conservatism of some sort, centre-left, Labour, social democratic, trade unionist, and so on. Now we have a racial intermedley that it complicates even that division. The distinction between the aristocratic and upper class attitude and the bourgeois attitude, which is as pronounced as any left-right split between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, is that which Evola advocates. Evola believes in some respects in masters and slaves, or certainly serfs. He believes that the merchant and those who deal purely with economics have to be subordinated to politics, to higher politics, to metapolitics, to military struggle. He believes that the warrior and the religious leader and the farmer and the intellectual stroke scholar stroke craftsman artist are uniquely superior to those that make money. And nearly all of Evola's views are in some ways a form of aristocraticism in a way. If you look at all of the sports that he favours, fencing, mountaineering, they all involve lone individuals who prepare themselves for a task which is usually dangerous and which can usually result, mountaineering for example, and his book Speculation on the Peaks, in annihilation and creates, if you go wrong, but it creates an extraordinary and ecstatic sense of self-overbecoming if you conquer K2, as a Peruvian mountain, the Eiger, the Mount Everest, and so on. And even in the more populist forms of mountaineering, the sort of bearded upper middle class, Chris Bonington sort of cheery mountaineering, as you might call it, there is a streak of aristocratic, devil-may-care, and Byronic license. The bourgeois view is, why do that? It's dangerous. It's pitiless, you can be hurt and injured, there is no profit, it serves no higher reason than itself. For Evola, the reason and the purpose is the reason to do it. It is the stages that you go through and the mental states you get into as you prepare and you execute a task which is dangerous. And the same analogy can be extended to martial combat, the same analogy can be extended to sports like ancient wrestling. Modern wrestling is a circus, of course, where the outcome is largely decided by the middlemen who negotiate the bouts between clowns, who can still damage each other very severely. But ancient wrestling was a bout that ended very quickly, and which was essentially religious, which is why the area that they wrestled in was purified with salt in most of the major traditions, and so on. Fencing. Take away the protective gloves and gear, and you have gladiatorial combat between people who are virtually on the brink of life and death. And these are the sorts of, only one step removed, even from Olympics fencing. It's noticed that in the contemporary Olympics, a movement that was founded in modernity on the Grecian ideal, nearly always founded by aristocrats, all of the early victors in shooting and fencing and all these early sports are aristocrats. Of course, the early Olympics have their funny side. Many of the female athletes that won early Olympic competitions were transsexuals. Of course, medical checks were instituted to prevent hermaphrodites and people of diverse genders and that sort of thing from competing in these competitions. But the individualistic sports in a mass age have been disprivileged and are largely regarded as strange wonderland sports that the masses only flip channels over in relation to the Olympics. For a man like Evelyn, for the sensibility which he represents, things like sport are not a diversion. They are targets for initiation in relation to processes of understanding about self, the other, and life that transcend the moment. So one bout leads to another moment of skill. It's as if these moments, which most people always strive to avoid rather than engage upon, are in slow motion. The whole point of Evelyn's attitude towards these and other matters is to go beyond that which exists in a manner which is upwards and transcendent in its portending direction. This is a society which always looks downwards. What will other people think? What will one's neighbours think? What will people out there think? What will this BBC audience think? What do the masses, left, right, centre, pressing their buttons on panels and consoles, think? The sort of Evelyan response is that what they think is of no importance. And they ought to think what the aristocrats of the world, in accordance with the traditions which are largely religious, out of which their social order comes, things. You can understand that this is an attitude which has not endeared this type of thinking to contemporary pundits and to the world as it now is. It's also inevitable that when Evelyn's books were published, they would enter the English-speaking world via the occult, via mysticism, via various types of initiated and individualistic religiosity. The whole point about the Western occult, whether one believes in the literal formulation that these people spout, or whether one believes in it metaphorically and quasi-subjectively, is that it's an individualistic form of religiosity. In simple terms, mass religion involves a small clerisy or priesthood, in the old Catholic sense, up there, and the laity are down there, and it's in Latin, medieval Latin, it's slightly mysterious. You partly understand it if you're grammar school educated, otherwise you don't. It's mysterious and semi-initiated, but you don't really know. The mystery is part of the wonder of the thing. You look up at them, and they've got their back to you, and they're looking up further beyond them, towards the divine, as they perceive it. Now that's a traditional form of mass religiosity, if you like. But the type of religiosity with which he was concerned was individualistic and voteic, and is essentially the idea that everyone in a small group is a priest. Sometimes is a priest and a warrior combined. One of the many scandals that we have in modernity is crimes that are committed by members of various religious groups and organisations. Many traditionalist-minded people believe that the reporting of these crimes in the mass media is deliberately exaggerated in order to demonise any retrospectively traditional elements of a prior and metaphysically conservative type in the society. But if one looks at it another way, and one of the things about Evelyn is the creativeness of the aristocratic mind that looks at essentially centrist and bourgeois problems in a completely different perspective. He would say about those sorts of scandals, which I won't belabor people with because everyone knows about them, that it's the absence of the dialectic between the priest, somebody who believes in something, somebody who believes in a philosophy that isn't just theirs and therefore relates to a society and relates to a continuing generic tradition out of which they come. Most contemporary philosophies are just my view as a tiny little atom, rather than my view as something that's concentric and links me to something larger and which can therefore be socially efficacious. But from an Evelyan perspective, the absence of the warrior or the martial and soldierly traditions and its interconnection with belief and that and the individual who believes is the reason for decadence or deconstruction or devilment or decay in these religious organisations. In his way of looking at things, there's a seamlessness between the poet artist, the warrior and the religious believer. They're different formulations of the same sort of thing because they're always looking upwards. And in a way, are deeply individualistic and egotistical, but transcend that. Because the concentration on oneself, on one's own thinking, one's own feeling, one's own concerns, one's own attitude towards this mountain, this woman, this fight, this text, is conditioned by that which you come out of and move towards. Evelyn doesn't believe in progress, nor does the tradition that he comes out of. They don't believe in scientific progress. They don't believe in evolution. But his anti-evolutionism is strange and interesting. It's got nothing or almost nothing to do with creationism and with, if you like, the evangelical politics of certain parts of what you might call the Puritan American right, for example. His attitude is a reverse attitude, which in a strange way is an involuntary and inegalitarian way of looking at the same issue. His view is that the apes are descended from us as we go upwards, rather than we are descended from them as we leave them in their simian animalism. So in a way, it's actually a reformulation of the same idea, but looking upwards and always seeing, if you like, the snobbish, the aristocratic, the prevailing, the overarching view, rather than viewing the thing from a mass, generic and middling perspective, which includes people. Tony Blair says the worst vice anyone can have is to be intolerant, is to be exclusive, is to exclude people. The nature of Britishness is inclusion, when of course the nature of any group identity is exclusion. And who is on the boundary, and who can be allowed in, and the subtleties and grains of difference that exist between one exclusive group and another, where one tendency of man ends and another begins. Evola believes, in a very controversial way, that decline is morphic and spiritual combined. In other words, races of man have a spiritual dimension, have a higher emotional dimension, have a psychological dimension, but never forget that Evola is not a Nietzschean, he is not somebody who believes it's all at this level. He believes that the gods speak to man, that God speaks to man directly and indirectly, and the civilizations that we come out of are based essentially on religious premises. Moderns who sneer at these sorts of attitudes, of course, forget that virtually every civilization that mankind has ever had, until relatively recently, and every civilization, the old documents and artifacts of which are included in the storehouse of the British Museum, just over there in central London, were religiously and theologically based. It's only really in a post-Enlightenment, late Scottish Enlightenment, English Enlightenment, French Enlightenment, 18th century plus sort of a way, that the secularization of Western Europe rivals the rest of the planet. Further east in Europe, less of it. Further south in Europe, a bit less of it. Religiosity on most of the other continents of the earth is still a primary force, but Evola would despise the sort of religiosity that prevails there, because he would see in it broken down thinking, syncretism. The people who would say he would be in favour of contemporary Saudi Arabia, for example, would probably be sorely disappointed. He would see, under the religious police, under the strict observance of this or that rule, American satellite dishes and modern devices, and that which is external and which has been in relation to modernity and which has been internally accepted. So Evola is always the critic, if you like, and always on the outside. Now, his career is quite complicated, because when he was a very young man, he fought in the Italian War, First World War on the Italian side. They, of course, fought on the quote-unquote Western or Allied side in that war, as is often forgotten. There's some extraordinary photos of him on the internet in these goggles and these helmets, looking extraordinarily fascistic, you know, and that movement hadn't really even been created then, you know. He looked like that in a Denunzian type way, stylistically, even before the gesture itself. Evola, of course, partly disapproved of fascism and National Socialism, even though he became very heavily implicated and or involved in both of them, because in his view, they weren't right-wing enough. They weren't traditional enough. They weren't organic enough. They weren't extreme enough. Evola is probably the only thinker in the 20th century who has written a slim volume criticising National Socialism from the right, not from any point to the left. He only aligned with these movements because they forced modernity to question itself, and because they were anti-democratic, and because they were ferocious and desired morally and semi-theologically, because few, including liberal critics, would deny that there was a semi-theological insistence to most of the radical European movements, even of the left, but certainly of the right, in the last 20th century, certainly the first half of the last century. And Evola saw in these movements a chance, but no more, which is why he flirted with them, why he wrote for fascist magazines in Italy, why he went to colleges run by Himmler's SS in Germany, why he was disapproved of by them, why he had sympathisers, Ernst Jünger-like, in them, partly protected him, why he was allowed to write with a degree of freedom, whilst giving a degree of loyalist obeisance to these structures, and yet at the same time to remain outside them. The question has to be raised whether Evola's philosophy is consonant with the creation of a society, or whether it will become if you like, a spirit of individualism. Evelyn was also involved at the beginning of his career in one of the most radical modernist movements of the 20th century, Dadaism, in Italy, and he produced some Dadaist paintings. Now, this superficially looks quite extraordinary, but of course there was a strong interconnection between certain early modernisms and fascistic ideologies. The reason that he became involved in Dadaism is quite interesting, and of all things, there is a talk on YouTube that lasts 4.5 minutes, in which Evola, as an old man, explicates why he was involved. He says the reason we got involved in these movements was to attack the bourgeoisie, was to attack the middle class, and was to attack middle class sensibility and sentimentality. The extraordinary radical anti-system nature of many radical right ideas, which is hidden in more moderate and populist variants, comes out staring at you full in the face in people like Evola. Many fascistic and radical movements of the right, of course, were peopled by adventurers and outsiders and quasi-artists and demi-criminals and religious mystics and madmen and people who were outside of the grain, the mainstream life, particularly people who were socialized by the Great War, which many of them experienced as a revolution. Wyndham Lewis, who was strongly drawn aesthetically to modernism and politically to various forms of fascism, and was a personal friend of Sir Oswald Mosley, once said that for us, the First War was a revolution, wasn't a war. We saw killing on a truly industrial scale. We saw the industrialization of slaughter. And one of the interesting ironies of the Evelolian, and in some ways Ernst Jünger's position about war, is that although thinkers like them are regarded by pacifists and liberal humanists and feminists as warmongers, there's a distaste for mass war in Jünger and Evola and the others, because it's the war of the ants, the war of the masses in blood and the dung and soil and gore. There is nothing chivalric about a man being torn to pieces by a helicopter gunship when he doesn't even have a chance to get his armalite into the air. Evola would prefer the doctrine of the champion. You know, when two medieval armies meet and one enormous hulking man comes out of one army in full regalia, trained in martial splendor and arts, as the previous speaker discussed, in relation to the Norse tradition, and another champion emerges, and they fight for a limited objective that leaves civilization intact on either side, but the one that is defeated will obviously pay dues to the other. Now, this shows the extremely sort of Byronic, individualistic and aristocratic spirit that lurks in Evola's formulations. The way his work has come down to us, of course, is the way he lived his life and the books that he wrote. It's interesting that the Anglo-Saxon world has received his literature through translations by mystic and occultistic publishers in the United States about Tantra, about Buddhism, about Japanese warrior castes and traditions, about the Holy Grail, about Greco-Roman, High Christian, pagan and post-pagan, Europeanist and other traditions. Another radicalism about Evola is total unstuffiness and absence of prudery in dealings with sex. Evola wrote a book called Metaphysics of Sex. He regards sexuality as a primal biological instantiation through which the races of man were renewed and replaced, but at the same time, he regarded it as one of the primary human acts, act of great energy and force that has to be channeled, has to be made use of, has to be transcended in and of itself. You have this odd commitment to Tantra, which is a sort of erotic extremism of occult excess, and a total opposition to pornography. Why? Because the one involves the commercialization of sex. The one involves money interrelated with sexuality. From this purely sort of primal perspective, money almost has no, unless a marriage is arranged between dynastic states or groups for particular statal purposes, which is fine, money has almost nothing to do with these areas of life. The disprivileging of money as the basis of everything, and the belief that the society that we have now is the result of the fact that every politician in all of the parties represented in the major assemblies, including radical right parties, essentially of a populist hue, believe in homo economicus. They believe that man is an economic integer and nothing else matters. Immigration? It's good for the economy, don't you know? Mass movements of capital around the world at the flick of a button on a screen, in exchanges all around the globe, particularly in the Far East now, but also ubiquitously. It's good for the economy. Everything is based upon the freeing of people from prior forms of alleged servitude due to economic enhancement. The sort of doctrines Evola holds are not neo-medieval, nor are they a desire to return to the ancient world with certain modern technologies. In some ways, they are a return to the verities that existed before the modern world was created. One of the most substantial critiques of this type of thinking is the belief that the modern world is inevitable, that all cultures and races will modernize and are doing so at a great rate of knots, that skyscrapers and enormous megalopic cities are being thrust up in the Andes and the Far East, and even client Chinese-built ones will emerge in Africa and elsewhere, and that it will be onwards and upwards forever in relation to what we have now. There are grotesque problems with that, of course, because to give every human on this planet, irrespective of race, kinship, clan, and culture, a middle American lifestyle, you will need 3 planets, 8 planets, 10 planets, or you may need them, in order to give them that middle American feeling, the 3 satellite dishes, the condominium, the 3 sort of Chelsea tractors outside on the driveway, the multiple channel TV, and so on. To give every African that, we will need many, many planets and many, many times the economic wherewithal that we have even at the moment. The interesting thing about Evola is that many issues that convulse people today, famine in the Third World, war in the Congo, HIV/AIDS, he would say, well, are interesting, of course, because they're things that are going on and everything has a meaning even beyond itself. But ultimately, they're unimportant. The number of humans on the earth doesn't matter to his type of thinking. Pain and suffering does not matter in accordance with his type of thinking. Indeed, he welcomes it as part of the plenitude of life, because life begins in pain and ends in pain. And most people live their entire life in the denial of the fact that life is circular, as his philosophical tradition believes the world is and meaning is. There is progression round the circle, but there is decline. And decline and death are part of an endless process of will and becoming. It is essentially, and in a very cardinal way, a religious view of life, but also a metaphysically pessimistic and conservative view of life in a profound way that the conservatism of contemporary liberal Tories like Cameron would almost not even begin to understand. To a man like him, theories of Evola's sort are lunacy. Are lunacy, quite literally. The return to the Dark Ages, the return to the Middle Ages, quasi-justifications of slavery, quasi-justifications of the Waffen-SS. This is what Cameron or his colleagues on the front bench, and his even more liberal colleagues on the same front bench, would say about these sorts of ideas. But the irony is that 300 to 400 years ago, most civilized structures on Earth were based on these ideas, that even the modern ones that replace them are based upon the contravention of these sorts of ideas, which means they realized they were real enough to rebel against in the first instance. And it's also true that even in the high point of modernity, post-modernity, hyper-modern reality, all the phrases that are used, when a war occurs, when the planes go into the towers in New York, when the helicopter gunships stream over Arabian sands, you suddenly see a slippage in the liberal verities and in the materialism and in some of the ideas which are used to justify these sorts of things. Not much of a slippage, but you suddenly see a slippage, what occultists and mystics call a rending of the veil, a ripping of the veil of illusion between life and death. What life is really about. Is life really about shopping? Is life really about making more and more money? Is life really about bourgeois status when one already has enough to live on? Is life really about eating yourself to death? These are the sorts of things that Evola's viewpoint pushes before people, which is why the majority will always push it away. His political texts are essentially revolt against the modern world, Men Amongst the Ruins, and sort of Riding the Tiger, which explore the nature of a man who is born now when most of the prior traditions of his culture and his civilization have collapsed. The civilization of man, the fact that Western cities have turned into third world sort of zones, the fact that semi-criminality is endemic, the fact that you go into a street, graffiti is there, rap music blares from a passing car, 20%, 40% of the street has no relationship to you aesthetically or ethnically or racially or culturally. Evola would see this as part of the inevitable climate of decline and spiralling downwards towards matter, which is intentional and volitional. The most controversial area of Evola is when he begins to unpick and reformulate many classic propositionalisms of what might be called the old right to determine what has occurred and why. Evola is essentially, although he began in a more subjectivist and changeable mood, Evola is essentially a deeply religious and aristocratic man. This means there is always a reason. Liberals believe that everything is a confusion, and everything is contingent upon itself, and everything is an accident waiting to happen. But like Christ in the New Testament, who believes that when two birds fall to the ground, the Father is aware, Evola believes that there is always a purpose and a reason. Evola believes that civilizations are collapsing in on themselves and tearing themselves apart internally for reasons that are pushed by elites and by forces which are manifest within them that will that desire. The endless atoms and causal moments in the chains may not know of that which is coming, that which is non-volitional, that which is partly pre-programmed. But he believes that these tendencies of mass servitude, mass death, mass proletarianization spiritually, mass plebeianism, mass social welfare, mass social democracy are willed, that the destructivity of prior cultural orders is willed and is definite, and certain racial groups are used to facilitate that destruction, and that other groups use them in order to achieve it. He believes in an aristocracy of man because he believes everything is hierarchical. There was an interesting moment in a by-election in East London, or Eastern London, just recently, when the chairman of the party that I used to be in a while ago was asked by a woman of Afro-Caribbean ancestry, are we equal with you? And the media's there, you know, 20 cameras are upon this individual, and therefore, given the logic and the paradigm that he is in, he said yes. He would probably want to say yes, but the media has gone on because it's got the required answer. Indeed, a lot of media investigation now is asking a politician to affirm their correctness before a prior methodological statement, and woe betide any of them if they show the slightest backsliding on any issue about which they should be progressive. Evola's answer, who can put words in the mouth of somebody who died a while back, but the answer of his type of thinking would be that that woman is unequal in relation to a black writer like Wole Soyinka. He's a Nigerian, he's from the Yoruba tribe, he won the Nobel Prize. Is he worthy of winning the Nobel Prize? Was he given the prize in the 1990s because it was fashionable to do? Rabindranath Tagore, the great Indian writer, and Brahmin and higher caste type won it in the 1930s. Probably wasn't too much political correctness then, but there was probably a bit even then. The Evolian answer is that she is not equal in relation to Soyinka, and Soyinka is not equal in relation to Chaucer, or Defoe, or Shakespeare, or Voltaire, or Dante, or Tolstoy, or Dostoevsky, or Wagner. That everything is unequal, and that everything is hierarchical, and that there's a hierarchy within an individual, and between individuals, and between groups of individuals, because everything is looking upwards, and everything has a different purpose in life. This means that those who are at the middle and at the bottom of an ethnicity, of a social order, of a gender, of a prior historical dispensation, should not be lonely in his way of looking at things, or afraid, or rebellious, or full of alienation and fear, because everyone has a role within a hierarchy, and people can move to a degree, although his viewpoint is essentially aristocratic and not meritocratic. A man like Nietzsche, who Bertrand Russell once condemned, as advocating aristocracy when he was not born in it or anywhere near it, a man like him would be accepted, but never completely accepted by an aristocratic caste. Things that are regarded as hopelessly naive and snobbish now, Evola regards as just due form. What is the worst thing in the world at the present time, according to Sky News? Probably discrimination. Discrimination of one sort or another. Evola would believe that discrimination is the taxonomy of an aristocratic sensibility. One reaches for a piece of cake, one discriminates. One has an arranged marriage with another member of the Sicilian nobility, one discriminates. One reaches for a sword to do down a bounder that one wishes to be with the flat of the blade. One discriminates between the weapon and the object of the rage, which is itself indifferent because it sees something beyond even itself. These are views, of course, which the majority of people will find cold, chilling, brutal, eagle-like, beyond almost their conception, almost forms of insanity, in actual fact, in relation to what is today regarded as normal or moral or even human. They are partly inhuman ideas in some ways, but they are ideas that most aristocracies and most warrior castes have had for most forms of human history. Everless books are now widely available to those who wish to read them. The great conundrum of his work is, does it portend to an asceticism? In other words, if the era of destruction, which is the Kali Yuga and the ideology which he puts forward, which is the Hindu age of destruction, where everything is broken and everything is melded together prior to decomposition, which will feed a universal rebirth at a future time, because mankind is seasonal, in relation to Spengler's view of the world, where his view of history is compared to plants and botany, to give it some sort of methodology, to some sort of structure. Don't forget, these are 19th century, early 20th century ideas. No history don, or hardly any history don today, believes history has a meaning. Carlyle believed that the sort of deistic nature of history impinged upon the decadence of the French royalist elite, and it led to the revolution because they didn't superintend France properly. He sort of believed, in his Protestant thundering way, from the pulpit of his study in the mid-19th century, that the French Revolution was a sort of an outcome that was partly deserved by a failing aristocracy. In other words, history had a meaning, it had a purpose. Nobody believes history has a meaning or a purpose. Certain anti-fascists would say Stalingrad had a purpose, but they forget that the Red Army shot 16 to 18,000 of their own men, and they stood 18 feet behind the commissars, behind the lines. They shot an army of their own men in order to win that battle. Just as certain secret polices in the Third World cut off the ears and cut out the tongues of many retreat in battle before they send them back to their villages. Would Evelyn approve of that? He would probably say if it was done individualistically or as a matter of revenge or of rage, it's dependent upon circumstances. But to do it in a mass-oriented way, mass camps, mass sirens, the totalitarian response, particularly of communism, the reduction of everything to the lowest common denominator so all can be free in a sort of pig-like uniformity, he would consider that really to be death and to be fought against. Evelyn is extraordinarily controversial because there is an area in his thinking, particularly in relation to the Islamic world, that leads almost to the justification, as certain liberal critics say, of forms of religious terrorism. He never quite advocates that, but it's quite clear his loathing of the modern world is such, and his nuanced appreciation of the Islamic concept of jihad, where you fight within yourself against doubt and fight externally and in a quasi-pagan and masculine way against the enemy that is without you, has a resonance that chimes with certain extremist religious people who basically want to blow the modern world up. So Evelyn is, as I say in my title, one of the world's most right-wing, certainly most elitist thinkers. The interesting thing about him is that everything always looks upwards, even his doctrine of race. You find in many racialistic movements a sort of socialism, that if you're of my ethnicity, you're quote-unquote all right, as if possession of a certain melanin skin content or absence of same was all that the thing was about. A sort of, when Norman Tebbit says that the British National Party is old Labour plus Powellite racialism, there is always a streak of truth to such viewpoints. Evelyn doesn't believe in that. Evelyn believes that race is spiritual as well as physical. If a man comes to him and says, oh, I'm white, you should be looking after me, mate, he would say, what is your intellect? What is your quality? What is your moral sense? What do you know about your civilization? How far are you prepared to fight for it? What pain can you endure? Have you had understanding of death in your family, in life, mature or for a profound human being, or are you part of the limitless universality, although you were born in a particular group which I respect and come from myself. That's the sort of principle he would have. Now, that is an attitude of revolutionary snobbery in a way, but it's snobbery based upon ideas of character. And in the end, as we know politically, character is a fundamentally important thing, and the absence of it, particularly in quasi-authoritarian movements, is poisonous, because people once in place cannot be removed except by the most radical of means. So there is a degree to which leadership is all important. Look at an army. An army is not a gang of thugs, but it can easily become one. An army can easily become a rabble, but armies are controlled by hierarchies of force, the nature of which is partly impalpable. Each squad has a natural leader. Each squad has an uncommissioned officer. Each squad has an officer above them. Each squad has an officer above them. In real armies, German, British armies of the past, one officer goes down, somebody replaces them from lower down, assumes immediately the responsibility that goes with that role. Even if all the officers are gone, and all the non-commissioned officers, the natural leader, the one of the 5%, most behavioural anthropologists believe that 1 in 20 of all people have leadership criteria and step forward in a moment of crisis and are looked to by the others because they provide meaning and order and hierarchy in a moment of stress. Have you ever noticed that when people undergo disaster or when they're in difficulties, they look for help, but they also look for people to lead them out of it? Leaders are never liked because it's sort of lonely at the top. But leadership is like probably the desire to believe in something beyond yourself, is inborn. And while the principle of leadership remains, where in even democratic societies, leaders are required in order to energize the democratic masses. Don't forget, most of the Caesarisms of modernity are red forms of Caesarism, forms of extreme authoritarianism and even pitilessness, all in the name of the people. All raised in the name of the masses and their glory and their freedom, their liberty and their equality. When Forbes magazine says that the Castro's family's wealth in communist Cuba is $70 million, when it calls them communist princes, when it's, don't forget, an ordinary man in Cuba can be imprisoned for owning his own plumbing business. When you realize that these people are princelings of reversal, you sense that some of the hierarchies, although they wear different names and different forms, are now occurring in an entropic phase or in a culture of decay, do relate to many of Evola's ideas. He would say, even in reversal, he would say this is because these ideas are eternal and are perennial and will out in the end. The traditional political right-wing criticism of these sorts of ideas is that they're purely philosophical. They relate to individuals and their lives. They tend to hermeticism and the ascetic view that a learned spiritual man, a man of some substance, can go off and live by himself and the rest can rot down to nothing and who cares. They say that they feed a sort of post-aristocratic misanthropy. Look at our own aristocracy. They probably lost power in about 1912. They were never shot like in the Soviet Union. They were never beheaded like in revolutionary France of 200 years before. But they have lost everything in a way because their function has been taken from them, hasn't it? The reason for those schools, the reason they were bred in the first place, the reason for all their privileges and so on has been taken away. The fascination with the Lord Lucan case in the 70s, the sort of decline of that class, you know, he listens to Hitler's speeches at Oxford, beats the nanny to death, can't even get the right woman in the basement. This sort of thing, couldn't even get that right, you know, couldn't even get the crime right, you know. It's the decline of a class, isn't it? You know, going down and knowing they've gone down as well. It's sort of Roswald Mosley's son enjoys being dressed up as a woman and spanked, and his son's just died of a heroin overdose. And it's not, and there, and yet Oswald Mosley is in that family chain. You don't need to really think that there is a sort of efflorescence there. It's a bit unfair on that family and so on. But don't forget, this was a class that was born to pitilessness and rule. This was a class that identified with eagles. That's why it put them on their shields and on their ties and on their schools. And now look at them. But of course, they have, in a sense, joined the rest, haven't they? They've joined the mass. What they once were no longer matters. Cameron sums it up in a strange sort of way. Traditionally, since the 1960s, the Tories have always elected pushy middle-class people with whom the mass of their electoral support can identify. It was always said Douglas Hume would be the last of the old breed. He was Premier when I was born. He would be the last of the old breed that would survive and thrive. When asked about unemployment in 1961, Douglas Hume said, "Well, there's a room for a second gamekeeper on my estate." And people said he was out of touch. Out of touch. And he was out of touch, but let's face it. But he thought that was a quite commodious and moral answer, you see. Cameron is strange because all of the ease before the camera, the ease before people, no notes, look at me, not a trembling lip, all of that ease is part of the genetics of what he partly comes out of. And yet all of his values are bourgeois. All of his values are middling and mercantile. All of his values are this society as it now is. Would Douglas Hume have joined or even given money to United Against Fascism, who he would have regarded as smelly little people on the margins of society, who were a left-wing rabble who probably need to be beating the grass somewhere or in my regiment? You see what I mean? The idea that he would identify with these people because the real enemy represents the seeds of the aristocracy from which one has fled, that wouldn't occur to him. He was too much what he was, basically, as a form, to really consider these lies and these legerdemain and this flight of fancy. One comes to the most controversial area of Evelyn's entire prognosis, and this is the belief that Jewishness is responsible for decline, and that they are a distinct and another race that pushes upon things and causes things to fall and be destroyed. These are the views, of course, the belief that there is a morphic element in the nature of the decline that has made him so untouchable and controversial. The interesting thing is, when he was approached about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is believed by all liberal humanist scholars to be a forgery, and a forgery of the Akron secret police based upon an alleged French novel, I think, of the 19th century, Evelyn said, "I'm not concerned whether it's a forgery or not." Which is a very interesting response, because in Evelyn's view of the world, his occultistic and hermetic view of the world, you can indicate something through its reversal. You can indicate something through metaphorization. Something can be emotionally true and not completely factually true. A text can be used to exemplify truths deeper than its own surface. This is a religious view of the text, of course, that the text does not end with itself. It's a medieval view, and is based upon a science of linguistic study called hermeneutics, where you would look at every word, you would look at every paragraph, you would look at every piece of syntax to deconstruct for essence rather than deconstruct to find the absence of essence. In the Western world, if you go to university now and you do any humanities, any arts, any liberal arts or any social science course, you will come across an ideology called deconstruction. Even vaguely, the semi-educated have heard of it. This is a viewpoint that says that any essentialisms, race, class isn't an essentialism, but it begins to become one in the minds of man, belief in God, gender, and so on. Any essentialism leads to the gates of Auschwitz. This is what deconstruction is based on as a theory. Therefore, you look at every text, you look at every film, because they're obsessed with mass culture, you see, looking at what the masses look at and what they're fed by the capitalist cultural machine. And they look at this and they say, "Oh, look, dangerous essentialism there. Do you see that in that John Wayne film? Do you see the way he spoke to the Red Indian?" Sorry, Native American, you know, this sort of thing. You see that sort of thing. And you look at these things and you break them down and you break them down again and you break down the element of sort of David Duke, quote unquote, logic that could be said to lie in that particular phrasing and so on. But the sort of analysis that Evelyn maintains is what you might call constructionism, rather than deconstructionism. And that's building upon the essences of things and bringing out their discriminatory differences. So to him, the fact that that text may have been put into circulation by the Okhrana, the Tsarist secret police, as a profound hermetic metaphorization for courses of history which may or may not be occurring is worthy of study. He again returns to the idea that everything has. If you want war with the Islamic world, the towers will fall. If you want a pacifist and isolationist America to enter the Great War, a particular boat with civilians on board but weapons underneath will be torpedoed by the Germans. If you want to get the isolationist boobs of Middle America into a global struggle in the early 1940s, you allow the prospect of an attack that you know is going to happen to occur, and you make sure that your aircraft carriers are not there, and you blame the middling officers who were there for the incompetence retrospectively, because it is the moment to kickstart democratic engagement with heroic and Spartan activities. Who can doubt that there is a streak of the Spartan? When an American Marine goes up a beach in Iwo Jima, or when he fights in Fallujah, some of the modern world has certainly fallen away for that man as he faces oblivion in warriorship against the other, even within the modern. And people like Evander and Younger would realise that. There's even at times in the extremity of modern warfare a return to the individual. What about these American pilots and these other pilots, these Russian pilots, who fly in these planes and the warrior is part of the plane? You know, they have a computer in their visor and they have all sorts of statistics that are coming up before them, and it's like a man who's an army fighting on his own, isn't it? He's got amount of force in under his wings which is equivalent to an army of centuries ago. So you have a return to elite individuals trained only for killing and warriorship at the top tier of present Western advanced military metaphysics. Because the interesting thing about Evola's way of thinking is it's creative. Most right-wing people are pessimistic introverts who don't like the world they were born into. But Evola seems to me to be, in some ways, an extravagant, optimistic aristocrat who always sees not the best side of everything, but the most heroic side of everything that goes beyond even itself. Even if the protocols of the Elders of Zion, in accordance with his diction, was a lie and can be proved to be such, the fact that millions were motivated to believe in it, millions to reject its causation, that people fought out the consequences and the consequences of the consequences in relation to even some of those ideas, means that it is of great specificity and import. Nietzsche has the idea that a man stands on the edge of a pond and he skims a pebble into the pond, and it skips across the water. You know, when you get the skimming right, and it goes and it goes and it goes, and wave upon wave moves upon the surface, and you can't predict the formulation of the wave and the current that it leads into, and that history has unknown consequences. The Maoist general who was asked by an American sympathizer after the Maoist Long March, itself partly mythological, "What's your view of the French Revolution?" And he memorably replied, "It's too early to tell, because it's only 200 years back." That is the sort of perspective that Evola has. And although there will be crushing defeats, and men are now of his sort, aristocrats of his sort, for whom the modern world has no time. Play polo, waste your money, sort of go to brothels, gamble all the time. There's no role for you. The world is ruled by machines and money and committees and Barack Obama. You know, American rightists call Obama Obamination. Like, instead of Abomination, that's a villain in a Marvel comic, actually. But never mind. Isn't he the signification for everything that is declining in America? And isn't all of these middle class tax revolt type movements, which are 100%, should we call them grassroots American, aren't they really within the allowed channels of opposition? He's a socialist, it's all about tax, it's not about anything else, it's all within the remit of healthcare, budgetary constraints, and bar views on same, etc., etc. What about the deficit? Aren't all of these movements and the sort of rage that they contain elements and spectrums of what he would call anti-modernity or semi-anti-modernity within modernity? None of us know what the future will hold, but it is quite clear that unless people of advanced type in our group believe in some of the traditions that they come out of again, they will disappear. And in Evola's view, they would deserve to disappear. So my view is, whatever one's view, whatever one's system of faith, and don't forget, in the Greek world, You could disbelieve in the gods and think they were metaphors, you could kneel before a statue of them, or you could have a philosophical belief in between the two. And all were part of the same culture, all were part of the same city-state, and if called upon as a free citizen to defend it, even Socrates would stand in line with his shield and his spear. All of Evola's books are now available on the internet. The most controversial passages about morphology and ethnicity are all available on the internet. Read Julius Evola. Read An Aristocrat for the Past and the Future. And look back at the perennial traditions that are part and parcel of Western civilization and can fuel the imagination and fire even of those who don't entirely believe in them. Thank you very much.